The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I'm going to be reading to you from Entrepreneur.com and the News and Observer. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. From 1971 until mid-1973, I had the privilege of living in what was then northern Ethiopia in East Africa. Now, that region later became the independent nation of Eritrea, which continues to this day. And one of the things I most remember from my time there were the trips outside of the urban area of Eritrea's capital, Asmara, and into the ancient, rural, and less populated lands that included Aksum, considered an ancient religious capital. Recently, I came across an article in Entrepreneur, a web-based magazine produced by Entrepreneur Media, which carried this headline: Archaeologists unearthed lost ruins in Ethiopia that have major implications for Christianity. As I read the article, I realized I was being updated on the history of a region where I had walked and hiked nearly 50 years ago. Our writer is Chernin Cannon, and his article appeared in the Entrepreneur website January 2022. So let's see what they have discovered and learn some more about this unique area. Laboring away in the rugged landscape of Ethiopia's northern uplands, a specialist archaeological crew are about to hit pay dirt. While the team excavate an area only 30 miles or so from the capital of the former kingdom of Aksum, they come across a building hidden by the earth. And this find isn't just remarkable for how it may affect our understanding of this ancient civilization. You see, the relics may also completely transform how we view early Christianity. Excavation begins. The potentially history-making discovery was made within the context of a five-year operation which started in 2011 and ended in 2016. And the work took place about 70 miles from the Red Sea and not far from Ethiopia's neighboring country of Eritrea, an excavation site once known as Beta Senmame. This site means house of audience when translated from an East African language called Tigrinya. Long overlooked. Before 2009, however, the area hadn't been of much interest to archaeological experts. In fact, the specialist's attention was only drawn to the site when people living nearby suggested that they should visit a certain hill. This slope, as locals knew, was historically critical, though the reasons for this weren't understood. Nonetheless, the hill had featured the native stories for generations. Numerous breakthroughs. So, led by Johns Hopkins University's Michael Harrower, the archaeologists eventually got to work in the area. And throughout the course of their research, the team had a number of important breakthroughs that have helped to paint a clearer picture of the region, as well as the ancient kingdom that once ruled there. A great trading empire. Although things were a little more vague before these discoveries were made, historians had already constructed a broad narrative of the kingdom of Aksum. Essentially, Aksum was seen to be a trading empire that at one point encompassed a vast area throughout East Africa and West Asia. In today's terms, it would have fallen within the borders of Ethiopia, Eritrea, Sudan, Egypt, Somalia, Djibouti, Saudi Arabia, and Yemen. Tracing the timeline, the kingdom also is said to have existed from roughly 100 AD to 940 AD, although its origins can potentially be traced back to the Iron Age. Apparently, Aksum got its start as far back as 400 BC before it developed further over the five centuries that followed. The city today. Records suggest, too, that the kingdom of Aksum was once a place called Mazaber. Within time, though, this status was transferred to an urban center known as Aksum, and the city of Aksum is still inhabited today, with just under 67,000 people calling the area home. A number of ruins and artifacts from the metropolis's ancient past are also still to be found in this region. Significant rivers. Meanwhile, a pair of hills rise into the sky at opposing ends of the city of Aksum, while two small rivers cut through the landscape of the area. These features, it's been posited, may have initially contributed to the development of the territory as an urban center, honoring the dead. Then there are the vertical structures known as the steles or stelas, which were erected by Oxum's ancient inhabitants. Found within the city, or vicinity rather, of cemeteries, these items were seemingly designed to honor the dead. And while the steles may be approximately 1,700 years old, they're nevertheless considered a symbol of modern Ethiopia. Obelisk of Oxum. Many of Oxum's steles were raised up, moreover, in an area known as the Northern Stela Park. But perhaps the example with the most checkered history is the towering 79-foot-tall obelisk of Oxum, which in 1937 was taken away from its rightful place by Italian soldiers. It was only in 2005, in fact, that the structure was brought back to Ethiopia and raised again 3 years later. Burial sites. So what exactly were the steles used for? Predominantly, it's thought that they included burial sites. These grand constructions may also have had circular sheets of metal that were embellished with shapes and patterns attached to their exteriors. One area in the western end of the settlement is even said to house resting places that date back to the 4th century. Their own currency. Interestingly, too, the Kingdom of Oxum was known for trading in a currency of its very own. This money is said to have started circulating towards the end of the 3rd century under the rule of King Indibus. And at that same time, Oxum emerged as one of the most significant powers on earth alongside China's three kingdoms, the Roman Empire and the Sasanian Empire. A force to be reckoned with. Trade was apparently one of the main ways in which Oxum forged itself as a force to be reckoned with. The kingdom was known to do business over great distances, meaning it could ultimately establish an intricate economy and society. In addition, Oxum was prone to extending its reach through military force. Precious exports. And it helped, too, that Oxum possessed large amounts of gold, which was taken both from within its own lands and from its vanquished enemies. Along with ivory, this precious metal was a significant export for the kingdom, with the Byzantine Empire seemingly happy to snap up any gold going. Other sources of income that were traded out of Oxum were slaves, salt, and perhaps bizarrely, the shells of tortoises. Adulis. With the help of camels, these products were brought to a port called Adulis en route to Oxum's trading partners, and from there the exports were seen away in exchange for other valuable goods such as cloth from Egypt and India, glass, and weaponry. Found containers of goods. A number of containers that were originally from the Mediterranean region have also been found at the archaeological sites of Oxum, suggesting that olive oil and wine were similarly transported to the kingdom. Oxum coins, meanwhile, have been discovered in places as far away as the Mediterranean, Sri Lanka, and India. And by the way, we were talking about Adulis a moment ago. This is an ancient city that was once along this Red Sea, and today it's called Zulu, and it is a part of Eritrea. And I remember hiking one day to the edges of the escarpment. Asmara, the capital city, is about 8,000 feet in elevation. And as you look down, you go looking toward the Red Sea, which is a good 110-15 kilometers away to the west. And as you look at that and you see that, and it's quite an amazing thing, there's also the salt flats down below, and you'll see occasional caravans of camels and maybe even some burros or their version of that, donkeys and mules, that'll be taking these big sacks of goods along these trading trails that go back, you know, eons. So it's kind of interesting that it still continues to this day. Now we get back to the story, eventually in declination. Yet in spite of this vast trading network, the kingdom of Oxum eventually started to fail toward the end of the 6th century. And while historians can't say for certain why this occurred, it's thought that the deterioration of agriculture in the region may have played a part. Rival groups may also have started to take over smaller areas of the kingdom. What led to its downfall? And Oxum's decline could have been hastened because its leaders set the heads of defeated tribespeople retain a certain degree of power. This enabled these chiefs to organize and execute uprisings against the larger kingdom, fundamentally weakening Oxum and perhaps contributing to its eventual downfall. disappeared completely. Then, at the beginning of the 7th century, Arab Muslims started to compete with Aksum for control of its sea trading networks. The main hub of the kingdom was forced to move too. Eventually then, Aksum fell into a slump, and by the end of the 8th century, it had disappeared entirely. The gods they worshipped. Throughout the course of its history, though, Aksum had an interesting relationship with religion. During the early stages of the kingdom, its subjects worshipped multiple gods, some of which were in fact specific to the area. One of these deities was Maram, who represented war and monarchy. Sacrifices. Other gods important to those within the kingdom were Habas, who was closely associated with the moon, and Astra, who was linked to Venus. Divine beings such as Mater and Beher were also offered up as animal sacrifices, particularly in the form of cows. Now, Christianity arrives. Then, in around the 4th century, Christianity finally reached the kingdom of Aksum. This is thought to have been made possible by the region's direct trading links to the Roman Empire, as the Romans had themselves recently accepted the relatively new religion. The rise of the churches. As a consequence of Christianity reaching the kingdom, churches subsequently began to spring up in the region. Monasteries were also founded, including one set up by Abuna Arwagawi, who was later made a saint. And those living in the kingdom of Aksum steadily took up Christianity too. In fact, the religion is still widely observed in Ethiopia today, and I should inject that the principal religion is under the Orthodox Ethiopian Coptic Church. Filling in the gaps. So while we do know some things about the kingdom of Aksum, there are still gaps in its history that need to be filled. And over recent years, Michael Harrower and his colleagues have been working to do just that. Some of their findings have even ultimately altered the way we view this ancient civilization. Evidence of writing. Harrower and his team started work in 2009 after they began an assessment of an area near a settlement called Yaha. You see, it's previously been suggested that this place was once the capital of a realm of predating the kingdom of Aksum. Numerous discoveries have been made in the area, including evidence of early forms of writing. Exploring the under-investigated is our next segment, but let me inject yet another fact here not included in the article. One of the oldest languages of the world is also associated with this area. It's called Ge'ez, and one of the earliest editions of the some forms of the Bible are printed in Ge'ez. Now, these are very hard to find, and you may find them in some of these monasteries tucked away in these hills in this area, but that just gives you an idea of how far back these things go. Now, exploring the under-investigated, despite this, though, there hadn't been much archaeological work in and around Yaha, and while in the 1970s experts did take note of certain sites that had been deemed significant, the broader territory hadn't been adequately investigated. So, Harrower and his fellow archaeologists sought to remedy the state of affairs. Locals pointed to one specific area, and people living locally pointed the archaeologists in the direction of a particular mound as they knew the geological feature was in some way significant. In 2019, Harrower explained to CNN the hill was part of the local oral tradition. They knew it was an important place, but they didn't know why. In any case, the archaeologists got to work, and during several operations between 2011 and 2016, many intriguing discoveries were made. Stonework from around the 8th century was taken from beneath the earth, for instance, yet arguably the most exciting find came in the form of the ruins of a Christian basilica or church. Basilica ruins shed light. The building measured up to about 60 feet in length and 40 feet in width, and it hosted a revealing array of artifacts. A golden ring with a stone bearing the likeness of a bull's head was discovered in the vicinity, along with almost 50 objects created to resemble cows. This implies that belief systems predating the arrival of Christianity were still around at the same time as the church. The ring. Speaking specifically of the ring, Harrower said to CNN, it paints an important line of evidence. The ring looks very Roman in its composition and its style, but the insignia of that bull's head is very African. It's very unlike something you would find in the Mediterranean world, and it shows the kind of interaction and mixing of these different traditions. stone carving. The team also unearthed a stone carving bearing a cross, an ancient text that translates into English as venerable. This was also a lettering nearby with an even more explicitly Christian flavor, as the words seemed to request that Christ be favorable to those who made use of the church, determining their age. Finally, the experts used carbon dating techniques on the objects with the aim of establishing when the building was first created. And incredibly, that process suggested that the church had been constructed all the way back to the 4th century. That would have been roughly around the time that Christianity was made legal within the Roman Empire. One of the first. And in a message sent to Fox News, the archaeologist involved in the excavation elaborated on their significant discovery. Early basilicas in Ethiopia were key places of Christian worship, they said, and the site appears to be one of the first Aksumite kingdom, built shortly after King Azana converted the empire to Christianity during the mid-4th century A.D. Implications for Christianity. The implications of this find are potentially immense, too. After all, it all but proves that Christianity swiftly spread about 3,000 miles away from Rome. Perhaps then the religion advanced with the help of trade links from southern Europe to Africa and parts of Asia. According to Smithsonian Magazine, archaeologist Helena Waldakiros has even suggested that Aksum was a nexus point for the Roman Empire and more southerly regions. Difficult to study. Christianity has at times proven to be a difficult subject for historians focused on these earlier centuries. Before the religion was legalized within the Roman Empire, you see, followers were often forced to practice their faith secretly for fear of mistreatment. As such, there's arguably an absence of evidence pertaining to Christianity's early spread. Oldest church in Ethiopia. But thanks to the discovery of this church, the period within which Christianity reached the bank or lands of Aksum has become clearer. As language expert Aaron Butts put it to the Smithsonian Magazine, this find is, to my knowledge, the earliest physical evidence for a church in Ethiopia. It's even been said that the place of worship is actually the oldest of its kind in sub-Saharan Africa. Questions how Christianity traveled. And the remains of the church have also called into question the traditional notion of how Christianity reached Ethiopia. Until recently, a common tale implied that Aksum ruler was converted by a missionary called Frimisius, a narrative that may now be challenged by what Harrower and his team have found. Evidence of church business. And the church's contents have also emphasized the importance of business-related activities in Christianity's dissemination. Inside the building, tokens used as a sort of currency for trading purposes were discovered. Items from the Mediterranean and an area today encompassed by the state of Jordan also prove that distant exchanges took place. Paints a picture of the past. Discoveries such as these have all the potential to paint a more vivid picture both of this region and how Christianity spread there. As an expert named Almagesed Baldados put it to Smithsonian Magazine, the Aksumite kingdom was an important center of the trading network of the ancient world. These findings give us good insight into its architecture, trade, civic, and legal administration. Posing an archaeological challenge, excuse me. Nevertheless, Harrower has mused on the difficulties that he faces in his job. Politics and religion are important factors in shaping human histories, but are difficult to examine archaeologically, he said. Despite the challenges, though, the work can be ultimately fulfilling and vital, especially when you make a momentous find on the level of the Aksum Church. And this is quite a revealing thing because in the Aksum area, there is a place called Liabella, which was also considered significant to the development of Christian religions. And it's interesting to go there and see some of these buildings that were churches and monasteries, quite unique. Liabella has one, for example, that's in probably what would be about a 50-foot, 60-foot deep pit, maybe even deeper. It's in the shape of a cross, and it's beautifully done, and you have to get down there climbing a rope. And it's restricted access, obviously, but quite unique, I must say. Now, from Ethiopia, we're going to come back home to North Carolina. And writer Will Harlan is going to opine on unlikely allies fight for North Carolina's first national scenic area. Will describes himself as a hippie and hunter who lives in rural Barnardsville near the proposed Craggy National Scenic Area in western North Carolina. His commentary was published in the January 24, 2022 online extra edition of the News and Observer. Hunters and hippies are raging at each other in other parts of the country, but in North Carolina, they're working together to create our state's first national scenic area. What has brought old-timers and new-age millennials together in our state? A big, beautiful forest. The craggy section of Pisgah National Forest includes 16,000 acres of world-class trails, waterfalls, ancient forests, and trout streams. For the past 8 years, folks of different backgrounds and beliefs have forged an unusual and unlikely partnership to permanently protect it. I consider myself one of those, quote, hippies, unquote. There's a lot more we have in common than you might think, says Alan Smith, a 73-year-old who's been hunting in Craggy's Forest for decades. People love the forest for a lot of different reasons, but we all share a deep connection with the woods. If you start there, good things can happen. 8 years ago, Smith sat around a wobbly folding table at the community center where a dozen other locals from the Craggy community, born-again Bible thumpers and witchy wildcrafters, had come together to talk about logging that had threatened the forest. They began spitballing ideas about how to protect Craggy's Forest, and someone suggested proposing it for National Scenic Area designation. After all, its panoramic vistas from the Blue Ridge Parkway were some of the most popular and photographed spots in the country. So they hatched a plan that included door-to-door conversations, flyers at the local gas station, and a community meeting with the U.S. Forest Service. "We didn't know what we were doing," said Stephen McBride, one of the neighbors around the table at that first meeting, "but we had to try. We just decided to go for it and got to work." The Craggy National Scenic Area proposal quickly gained momentum. Over 10,000 supporters submitted comments to the U.S. Forest Service. The proposal received unanimous bipartisan resolutions from support of the Buncombe County Commissioners and Asheville City Council after hundreds turned out at their meetings. The Craggy National Scenic Area also earned the support of the Nantahala-Pisgah Forest Partnership, a coalition of 30 diverse organizations that includes the timber industry, leading conservation groups, national hunting organizations, and an array of recreation organizations. And just last week, the Forest Service recommended special protections for Craggy as a forest scenic area in recognition of its outstanding and unique ecological and recreational qualities, and that would have been the week of January 16th of this year. The Craggy National Scenic Area is now only one step away from becoming a reality. It still needs one of North Carolina's senators to formally introduce a bill. Senator Tom Tillis is an avid mountain biker. Senator Richard Burr is retiring this year and looking for a legacy. Craggy could become the country's 11th National Scenic Area. Virginia already has two National Scenic Areas. Georgia has one, too. It's time for North Carolina's scenic splendor to receive the national recognition it deserves. Craggy has it all. Big waterfalls, panoramic views, iconic trails. The Hunger Games and Last of the Mohicans were filmed in Craggy, and its pristine mountain streams provide drinking water to communities downstream. That clean water is important to North Carolina breweries and businesses, as well as area farmers like Anna Littman, who owns Ivy Creek Family Farm, just a stone's throw from Craggy. "We don't want our creek running brown or drying up. We depend on the forest to protect our farm," Littman says. "We need to keep the forest just the way it is." Ivy Creek Family Farm is one of over 150 area businesses and organizations that have endorsed the Craggy National Scenic Area. Across three presidential administrations, unlikely allies have partnered to build unanimous bipartisan support for the Craggy National Scenic Area. This is a rare opportunity to show that communities matter, democracy still works, and public lands can bring us together. And as we said, our writer is a hippie and hunter, and he lives near rural Bernardsville, and that's just near that proposed Craggy National Scenic Area. If you want to learn more about this, they have a couple of websites for you to look at, iheartcraggy.org. That's iheartcraggy, iheartcraggy.org, or iheartpisgah.org. Pisgah spelled P-I-G-A-H, iheartpisgah.org. So a couple of places to get some more information if you're interested. Well, public lands is an ongoing theme when it comes to issues like the environment, growth, and yes, travel. Our next story, and we're going to just be reading excerpts here, focuses on a new published book by Greg Peters. He was recently interviewed by David Jasper of the Bulletin newspaper, which is based in Bend, Oregon. His question and answer article appeared in the January 22, 2022 online extra edition of the News and Observer. Headlined, "Our National Forest," Arthur talks about the importance of public lands. Greg M. Peters is a Missoula, Montana-based writer and editor and the author of the newly published book, Our National Forest, Stories from America's Most Important Public Lands. Peters is the former director of communications at the National Forest Foundation and was the editor of its magazine, Your National Forest. He weaves history, expertise, and personal experience in our national forest. The Camping Life author, Brandon Leonard, described it as bringing to life American history through the prism of its national forest and an inspiring reminder of the incredible resource that we have in our public lands. Peters, whose book includes more than 150 photographs, also tells the story of the U.S. National Forest System, recently engaged in an email interview with the Bulletin, and some answers were trimmed for length. One of the questions, can you tell readers about your National Forest background and what led to your writing Our National Forest? Well, answer, growing up in Maine, I knew very little about our National Forest. When I moved to Alaska after college, I ended up living off the grid in a cabin on a private inholding at the Chukchka National Forest in Alaska. That experience helped me learn a bit more about our national forest, but it wasn't until I was fortunate to land a job at the National Forest Foundation in 2010 that I really came to understand the system. I worked for the NFF until 2018 and ended up as the communications director, where I wrote a lot about national forest and edited the organization's semi-annual magazine. While at the NFF, an editor for the Timber Press named Will McKay reached out to the organization to inquire if we wanted to help Timber Press produce a book about national forest. As the communications director, I ended up talking with Will and casually mentioned that I'd love to write a book like that. Will was open to the idea, asked me to develop a formal proposal, and after finding some contract work that could help pay my bills, I left the NFF at the end of 2018 and started working on the book. Question: what do you believe is or should be the audience for the book? Answer: well, I wrote the book for folks who are interested in learning more about this particular set of public lands. While at the NFF, I learned how little the average American knows about the national forest system. Even many folks who live near forests likely don't understand their history, their role in America's amazing public lands heritage, or how they're managed. The book isn't a history of the forest or the Forest Service, though. There is a fair bit of history in it. It's a collective of narrative nonfiction stories that weave together national forest history, important figures, current and past policy, and conservation concepts as they relate to topics like wildlife, wildfire, reforestation, recreation, and restoration. Each chapter can be read individually, and hopefully each provides context and information about that topic without getting too bogged down in minutiae. To be honest, it's probably not a great book for folks completely unfamiliar with public lands. It's aimed at people who want to know more about the national forest and how this set of public lands deals with things like recreation, wildlife habitat, diversity, equity, and inclusion. So some interesting points there made as we tell you a little bit about this book that's about public lands, and maybe one day we'll be able to read some excerpts from that. But for the moment, that's going to end today's episode of Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be joining us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Now, questions and comments may be directed to 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.